Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you've joined us. The Archdiocese of Seattle has released the names of 77 Catholic clergy or religious order members accused of sexually abusing minors. Some of the abuses on this list date back to the 1920s. Greg Mignone is a spokesperson for the Seattle Archdiocese. He says the church has taken a number of steps over the years to address child sexual abuse by clergy.
And we're taking this step now to build on that and to increase our accountability, our transparency, and maybe most importantly, to encourage anyone that's been abused to step forward.
The Archdiocese is facing civil lawsuits over abuse of priests. What do you say to critics who think you're just trying to sway public opinion?
Well, I think our record pretty much establishes that we're sincere in our efforts. We first became aware of the problem of clergy child sexual abuse back in the late 80s. Since that time, the Archdiocese has built a record of response, and when our Archbishop came in 2010, he reviewed that response and assured that all the steps that we're taking to do background checks, to teach people how to identify and prevent clergy sexual abuse, are effective and that we're doing all that we can. And in the course of that work, one of the things that came up was the idea of releasing the names, and it became clear that it was the right thing to do, and we decided to do it for that reason.
This list of names takes us back to the 1920s. You're saying The Archdiocese wasn't aware of this abuse until the late 1980s?
Well, you have to remember that the incidents of abuse, by and large, occurred in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, just as they did across the country.
Would you say that sexual abuse of kids, minors, has been systemic in the Catholic Church in Seattle?
No, I wouldn't. The instance of child sexual abuse is pretty much the same over that period of time, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, as it was in the general population. It was around 4%. And that's pretty similar to what happens in the general population. But we hold ourselves to a higher standard. That's in no way intended to offer an excuse for this tragedy.
How much sexual abuse do you suspect is still happening now?
This is a societal problem. Child sexual abuse is a problem that the entire society and culture needs to become aware of and needs to take action to prevent and eradicate. And what the church is doing now is it's training people that work for the church and volunteer for the church. It's training all of our clergy to identify and prevent abuse. For anyone to say that it's not a problem, they're simply not dealing with reality. It is a problem, but I think that when you take responsibility for it, when you acknowledge that it's a problem, then you can begin to address it.
The press release you sent out includes a phone number for victims to report abuse to the Archdiocese. Why would a victim call the Archdiocese instead of calling police to report a crime?
Well, there's a couple of good reasons for that. Number one, if they call our hotline and the abuse that they're reporting occurred years and years ago, it's probably beyond the statute of limitations for criminal action, and so law enforcement is not going to do anything with the allegation. If they contact us, we will conduct our own independent investigation. We have an independent investigator who's an expert in these cases, and we will have that individual investigate those in the absence of a law enforcement investigation. If the abuse is more recent, we will tell the individual to contact law enforcement. And if law enforcement does an investigation and it is not conclusive, we will conduct our own investigation until we can determine whether or not that allegation of sexual abuse is credible.
Why should victims trust the Archdiocese with their story now after the church has ignored or even tried to bury these allegations in the past?
Well, we certainly don't expect people to take our word for it. What we do expect, though, is that individuals would give us the opportunity to work with them, to provide healing, to do the kind of work that we've been doing now consistently over the last 13 years and judge us on the merits of our actions.
We're talking with the spokesperson for the Archdiocese of Seattle, Greg Mignone. Some people have left the Catholic Church after hearing of these abuses. Why do you stay?
As I said, this is not a measure of the effect of the Catholic Church in society. The measure of the Church's response and presence in society is the fact that we are the ones who, our mission is to serve vulnerable populations. We serve the elderly, we serve the poor, and we serve children. And sadly, there was a period of time when some of those who were given that sacred trust did not honor the trust, and the Church itself and some of its leaders did not respond in the way that they should have. That is certainly true, but now we're taking responsibility for those failures of the past. We're acknowledging them. We've apologized repeatedly. And one of the things that individuals can do if they either suspect abuse or have been abused is that they can request a meeting with the Archbishop so that he can meet with them and personally offer his apologies to them.
That's Greg Mignone, a spokesperson for the Seattle Archdiocese, which has released this list of 77 clergy or religious members who are accused of sexually abusing minors in Western Washington. There is a group called Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, and the Northwest director is Mary Dispenza, and she is a survivor herself. A warning here, her story might not be appropriate for all listeners. Mary Dispenza told me that when she was 7 years old in Los Angeles, her parish priest abused her while she was watching a movie.
I started walking up the center aisle, and the priest was seated next to the projector, those old-fashioned projectors, and beckoned me to come and sit on his lap. And so, of course, why would I not? And then that is when he digitally raped me. And in a way, my world stopped, and I can still imagine that movie just kind of fading out. I've often tried to say, well, what was playing? You know, I get put some of the pieces back together. And then beyond that, my memory is simply that he walked me to the back of the parish hall, left me, and I went into a very small bathroom there, and I washed my hands and in a way left half of me there and went out and back to my mom and the women in the lunchroom and never told anyone. And from that point on until age 52, I buried that and my other thought that from the second to the fourth grade, that carried on in different ways.
Mary, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
When you first read this letter from the bishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Seattle, you saw that list of names,
right,
of clergy and employees. What did you think?
First of all, it's long overdue. Why? And why at this time is it coming out? Did some case preclude it or force this issue for the Bishop Sartain to disclose the names? Did law enforcement, what actually was the reason behind it was one of my thoughts. And then another thought was, yes, it's a positive action, of course, because any time a predator is disclosed, kids are safer. And so there was, I was happy that the diocese was releasing these names finally, questionable as to their motive, and wanting them to do more.
What more do you want?
Well, perhaps they could post the pictures in the parishes where these predators connected on the back parish bulletin board And if they do know the whereabouts of a predator, to give a simple statement or two about last we knew of Father so-and-so, he is now located wherever.
Our listeners just heard the spokesperson for the Archdiocese saying, we're investigating, we're monitoring, we're using best practices to identify and prevent abuse. How satisfied are you with that?
Well, I'd like to know what best practices mean in this regard. And I have heard that the bishop said that there are no existing predators in the Archdiocese at this time. And I question that because I think there is such a degree of secrecy in the culture of the priesthood. And I think it would be impossible and an error to think that now we've released 70-some names and so we can sit back for a while and believe that we've identified everyone. I don't want the diocese or the good people in the pews to sit back and go breathe a sigh. Oh, great. This is taken care of now. We can put that aside. We cannot put it aside because priest abuse continues to go on probably right now as we are speaking, some child or youth or vulnerable young adult is being taken advantage of by a clergy member.
What would you have liked to see the church do differently?
First, victims need to go to the police because what has happened to them is a crime, not to the church, because churches can't police themselves. I'd like to see priests expose their brother priests, not protect them. Like Dave Jaeger is listed on that list, and I worked with him, and he has since passed on, a charismatic figure, a great man, and he molested children. And what the church did mostly, the Archdiocese of Seattle, protected him. And instead, any clergy member who has committed a crime needs to be exposed, not protected. I would like the bishop to also say to his priests, and I'd like to see it in writing, I encourage all of the priests under my care, should they know anything about the involvement of another priest or even be concerned, I want to know. I've never seen that asked by the Pope and or by archbishops.
Mary Dispenza, Northwest Director for the group SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, talking about the release of names of 77 clergy or religious members accused of sexually abusing minors in Western Washington. The Seattle Archdiocese released that list a few days ago. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon to you. The city of Seattle has racial and social justice as part of its official mission, but there's still work to be done. Yesterday, local leaders came together with citizens on Martin Luther King Jr. Day to talk about the work that needs to be done. Here's KUOW's Joshua McNichols.
It started in the morning with outrage. Local civil rights activist Marissa Janae Johnson spoke to reporters on a sidewalk corner. You might remember her for interrupting Bernie Sanders when he was here.
What we see in this white progressive utopia is that black people are still enslaved. They are still brutalized. That's why black resistance in Seattle is so key.
Later in the day, people met in workshops at Garfield High School to take that kind of anger and use it to fuel social change. Elmer Dixon is a former Black Panther. He asked people in his workshop, "What are you gonna do?"
If you have the will and you have the determination and you've identified the problem, you need to begin to organize. Don't wait. Don't say, I can't do it because I don't have 10,000 voices. Get up off your ass and do something.
In the audience, Martin Wilcox responded to Dixon's call.
I think, for me, I'm going to work with youth. That's really my passion. yeah, I have a great job and I'm a veteran, I'm this and I'm that. But when I really look at my life and where I feel like I'm being led, it's to enlighten men as to who they really are. Because I think that's the burning question of a person. Who am I?
Wilcox said when he was a kid, the signs of white people's success were all around him.
The average white kid knows who he is. He looks at a building. He looks at even money.
It's true. Most of the people on our national currency are old white dudes. In contrast, Wilcox said young black men feel pressured to fit a stereotype, to be a tough guy.
And we watch people, you know, get all these opportunities that we don't get because we're more invested in a stereotype because we don't know our real history, who we really are.
Wilcox wants to teach black youth about their history. The former Black Panther Dixon said that's important.
That's how you undo institutionalized racism. You give these young black kids identity and worthiness.
After the workshops, people gathered in a gym at Garfield to rally before the big annual MLK Day march. Local rapper Dre's celebrated the day's work by calling people to put their fists up. And from there, people marched by the hundreds down to the federal building. Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Employment is at an all-time high in Washington state, but a new report from United Way finds one in every three families in the Pacific Northwest cannot make ends meet. That includes people who are above the poverty line, but just barely. The United Way has a name for people in that situation: asset limited, income constrained, employed, or ALICE. The president of United Way of Pierce County, Danya Panapinto, told Jeannie Yandel what life looks like for an ALICE.
It's someone that's getting up and going to work, but they're having to make really tough choices. You know, do they put their child in a quality child care program, or do they look for some other alternative to child care, which may not be the best? It may not be safe. It's someone who has to make a decision as to whether or not they're going to pay for medication. Versus putting meals on the table, or you know, the whole issue of transportation. You know, ALICE families are one paycheck away from an emergency, so any type of an emergency will cause them to go immediately into crisis, and then you know, at risk of homelessness or at risk of losing their job. Yeah, and things begin to spiral out of control. And if we think about our own families, if we think about our neighbors, you know, think about our coworkers, that could very well be ALICE.
Donna, you were just talking about what it costs for someone in an ALICE group, what a budget looks like. You're the president of the United Way of Pierce County. We're in King County. What difference, if any, is there between an ALICE in Pierce County and an ALICE in King County? What do their budgets look like? What do those choices look like?
Well, you know, the report looked at each county differently, and the household budget is based on just the cost of living in those particular communities. So it's going to vary from, you know, King County to Pierce County, Snohomish County, and others. But, you know, some of the things that, you know, we also looked at and why there are so many ALICE families is, you know, low-wage jobs dominate our local economy. On average, more than half of the jobs in the Pacific Northwest pay less than $20 an hour. Now, this isn't an income issue, but that plays a role in it. The cost of living in some communities is higher than others. And then jobs are not located near housing, and that is affordable. And so, again, it's the transportation issue. And you have a lot of rural parts of the state where there isn't access to transportation and there aren't jobs, many jobs in those communities. And so people are struggling to just figure out how they're going to get to the jobs that are available. And then when you look at public and private assistance, yes, that can be available for a lot of families, but a lot of families aren't eligible for those different benefits. And that's not the solution to ensuring that someone's more financially stable.
This report finds that one-third of all families in the Pacific Northwest fall into or below this ALICE group, this asset-limited, income-constrained, employed group. What does that mean for everybody who doesn't fall into that group?
Well, the consequences of households that are living below the ALICE threshold, one of the things that really stood out to me in the report is this whole issue of transportation. We know that that impacts everyone. And with someone who is ALICE, you know, there's lots of things that are impacted. They may have unreliable transportation and then risk of accidents and so forth. But the impact on the community is really even greater. You know, workers are stressed because they're late. There's higher insurance premiums, unsafe vehicles on the road, more traffic on the road. There's a greater burden on road maintenance services. And then, too, for those ALICE families that don't have cars, there's reduced economic productivity, and there could be higher taxes as well. So it's just a greater burden overall. So when we think about these families, and again, why this report is so important, is that it's meant to shed light on the fact that so many families are struggling, and it has so many implications on all of us.
Well, now that you have all of this information, Donna, what do you do with it?
In the Pacific Northwest, every United Way is going to look at this information differently. But I do know it's an opportunity to have a conversation, to bring together the public and the private sector to talk about what are some short-term solutions to removing some of these barriers, as we talked about with regards to transportation. You know, housing, childcare, you know, what are some of those things that we can be doing locally? But it's also an opportunity to have a larger discussion, a more systemic discussion about policy issues and how do we engage policymakers and our legislators in, you know, again, pointing a light to this population that's so critical to the economy.
Donna Ponapinto, president of United Way of Pierce County, telling Jeannie Yandel about a new United Way report that one-third of the families in the Pacific Northwest are either below the poverty level or hovering just above it. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon to you. Now, I know you can see physical changes to the Seattle area. You see more cars on the roads. You see more cranes in the sky. What about the changes we can hear? Seattle writer Knute Berger hears one of those changes in the way people are talking about Puget Sound. He hears people sticking a definite article where it does not belong by calling it the Puget Sound.
You hear it a lot on radio, commercials, TV, but also in conversation and occasionally in print, too.
And what's wrong with saying the Puget Sound?
It just sounds wrong. It just sounds wrong. I mean, you talk about the Chesapeake. Everybody kind of gets that. You talk about the sound.
We say the Columbia River. What's the difference?
Rivers get the. But certain things don't get the. Puget Sound is one of them. Other sounds, Howe Sound. I mean, there are other Long Island Sound. Nobody says the Long Island Sound. For some reason, certain water features are exempt from the.
So sounds don't get the for reasons that you don't know, and
yes.
Why do you care?
Why do I care? It's like when people say Pike's Market.
Right.
You know, it just grates. It's the audio equivalent of like a fingernails on blackboard. So I actually, this thing had been annoying me for some time. I'd occasionally complain to somebody like, oh, no, it's Puget Sound, not the Puget Sound. So I actually tried to dig into the history of what we called Puget Sound. And it turned out, you know, be kind of interesting. I mean, when Captain George Vancouver came here, he named the body of water out there after one of his crewmen who had done a lot of the exploration. And he called it Puget's Sound. So with the possessive
apostrophe S.
Yes, apostrophe S. And that occasionally showed up in the 19th century. You'd see occasional references. And I'm going through like online databases and stuff of frontier newspapers in the 19th century. There were a few early references to the Puget Sound, usually in national newspapers in the very kind of the 1840s, that kind of thing. But people here have always said Puget Sound without the from the very beginning, from early settlement on.
Well, for being consistent, what did the first people living here call it before Vancouver and Puget?
Well, yeah, it didn't have a name. It wasn't named.
Oh.
Harvey Manning, many years ago, the outdoor writer, once proposed changing the name to Wolge, which was apparently the Lachutseed word for sea or salt water. And he didn't propose the Wolge. But we do say the Salish Sea. You know, people tend to put the there. Seas tend to get thes. The Mediterranean.
Okay, but you are a very thoughtful man. I know this about you. You say it, well, it just kind of bugs me. But does it say more? Why does it matter?
Well, there are two things. One is that, and I've talked to professors about this, the word the is disappearing from English. And they can demonstrate with computers and whatnot, analysis of linguistics, and not only English, but French, German, Spanish, other European languages. We don't use the word the as much as we used to.
Because of texting?
Nobody knows exactly why. And it's actually the word the actually tends to represent something that's kind of goofy and like the Google.
Right.
Or I was
the internets.
Exactly. Yeah. I was on I went to a Patti Smith concert, and she talked about, you know, kind of jokingly about being on the YouTube.
Right.
So the use of the word the in certain contexts is actually seen as kind of clueless, etc.
Old.
Then the other use of the word the that you see more of that didn't used to exist on commercial radio, references to highways. And in California,
like the 405. Yeah, I lived in California.
Right, California.
People say the 405,
the 405, the 520, that kind of thing. Up here, it was never that. It was always 520,
yep.
55.
Yep.
And in California, they also have the in front of a bunch of highway names like El Camino, the Nimitz, the Embarcadero,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. Well, I think the California influence in broadcasting has brought the to our highway references. Because now you hear the 5, the 520.
I have heard that
the
more.
The 405.
Yeah.
You're hearing more of that.
So that's why it bugs you. It's Californians.
Yeah, exactly. And so and then you see it's now sneaking into area codes. So on radio call-in yes. shows, they always say, well, the 206 says.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
The 425. Yeah.
So I think it's a California-ism,
mm.
kind of anachronistic California-ism that kind of came in through broadcasting. And then one reason, you know, it runs counter to the sort of greater trends is that language tends to simplify itself over time. So words tend to be shed. I talked to a professor up in Canada who was telling me, for example, that Broadway in New York was originally called the Broadway. Mm. And then it became Broadway, and then it became one word, Broadway. So that's usually what happens. But we're kind of running counter to that.
Bigger picture, though, Knut, as you know, words change.
Yes.
Things, see, as you write, as you wrote in your columns, Seattle was New York Alki, which we now say Alki, and then it was Duomps, and then it was Seattle. So, again, I say, what if the Puget Sound becomes correct? Because that's what people say. So what?
Well, you're right. I mean, so what? It's like the changing language, changing names. It's all part of the thing. The question is sort of what significance does it have? I suspect it's due to certain influences, but, you know, we'd need some kind of grant to go out and actually study it. And so all I have to go on my basis now is I am noting, maybe I'm a canary in a coal mine, mm. I'm noting a change. I don't know what that change means. Most people probably don't care. Although I got a ton of mail.
People do
care. The Puget Sound, it really bugs people.
What have people been saying to you?
Most people are in agreement. You know, that really bugs me too. And then people will talk about the other things that bug them. Pike's Market, you know, is kind of high on the list.
You know what you sound like? A mossback.
Shocking.
Seattle's own mossback there, Knut Berger, writer for Crosscut, telling you to quit it. Stop saying the Puget Sound. It's fun to tell other people what to say, so let's do that on the Facebook right now. Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Converse about what you want people to know when they talk about the place where we all live. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray is considering opening two new designated parking areas in the city for RVs. Sources in City Hall say an announcement is expected today. Parking areas for RVs. They're like tent camps, but for people living in their vehicles. RVs have become a source of controversy lately, with some residents of Ballard and Magnolia and Queen Anne saying they want these vehicles off their streets. They say RVs have become places for crime. On the other side, homeless advocates say cracking down on RVs will just make it harder for Seattle's homeless people to get by. For one perspective on this issue, I spoke with Bill Curlin Hackett. He directs the Interfaith Task Force on Homelessness. I also spoke with Magnolia resident Harley Lever. He created the community group Safe Seattle to demand solutions to the RV problem. Lever says crime and trash are two of the biggest issues with RVs in his neighborhood.
We have RVs that are dealing heroin. We've got RVs that are manufacturing crystal meth. We've got RVs that are working and coordinated with burglary groups. We've got reports of prostitution in these RVs. We've got hypodermic needles all over the city. We've got gallons of sewage everywhere. And we've got, 59% property crime. We've got people breaking into people's houses. And so, that's really the biggest problem with some of these RVs.
Bill, do we agree on the scale of the problem, hypodermic needles and gallons of sewage?
Well, I don't agree that the source is all coming from people living in RVs. I think, I've seen plenty of people who have a house deposit their trash in an unlocked trash container, especially at faith communities. We see that all the time. People leave couches by there. So a lot of people are looking for a place to put trash. That's just a given. And so I don't even attribute all the needles to being people in vehicles, because I look at the population and just logically it doesn't make sense. We've got drug users everywhere, and where they do their drugs, we don't control that. And where they dispose of their needles, we don't control that. And I don't actually see a lot of resources going to people in vehicles right now. That has been one of our complaints as well. So we agree with you that more resources need to be more intelligently directed toward people in vehicles. Some of that will be towards crime, which I 100% agree with you. We need to alleviate that. We need to see crime stopped. It's a risk for everybody. If there's production of drugs, absolutely. Of course, selling, all those things. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it originates in homelessness. Homelessness is caught up in it right now.
Harley Lever's group, Safe Seattle, has been calling for the city to create designated parking areas for RVs, like the ones Mayor Murray is considering. But Lever also wants to take it further. He wants to ban RVs from parking on Seattle streets. And he says that's not criminalizing the homeless. It's helping them.
If you're a homeless vet, if you are a drug addict, if you are someone trying to escape sex abuse, we can't let drug dealers, prostitution rings, and burglars live among you. The first victims of these crimes or these criminals are often the homeless people. So we need to separate them. And then the other thing is it really just is about saving resources. I mean, we spend the third most out of any city with homelessness, and I think that's a great thing about Seattle. The problem is we have homelessness went up 21% last year. So this is about saving resources, because the police can't handle it, the parking enforcement can't handle it, and SDOT is getting overrun. They can't handle it. So we've got more desperate people out on the streets that need our attention, and I think that as many resources as we could possibly shift towards them is important in the short term. In the long term, if we solve this issue, sure, maybe we can have a place for RVs to park. But right now, they just eat up a lot of resources that we don't have.
There's a lot of ways we can do this that aren't that sledgehammer of banning everybody. We want more precise remedies that don't harm the people who are most at risk. And that's always my concern. I mean, no offense to the neighbors. Mm-hmm. When we have a roof over our head, we're not the most at risk. So when you talk about banning all RVs from the streets, for example, I just kind of go, well, where would they go? It is very difficult to survive as a homeless person. We had more than 65 people die on the streets last year as homeless. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very expensive to live in your vehicle. It's actually more expensive to live in your vehicle than in a tent, because you have to keep your tabs current. The car has to keep running. You have to have gas for it. You should have insurance, although I think everyone's a little flexible about that. Do you have title? Are you parked within the 72-hour limit, or are you parked in some place where you don't have 72 hours to stay there? I agree that the ability to restrict where people park on the street doesn't necessarily criminalize them, but to say they can't park anywhere on the street then becomes a constitutional issue, because they have the same freedoms we all have.
So, as you can hear, they don't agree about the scope of the problem. But Lever and Curlin Hackett do agree on one solution: designated parking areas for RVs. Both of them say these tent camp type areas for vehicles are a step in the right direction. Curlin Hackett, who directs the Interfaith Task Force on Homelessness, says he's been pushing for this solution for a long time, and he appreciates the neighborhoods raising their voice.
It's awakened some leaders to, oh, we need to respond. And they don't want to just respond with a sledgehammer.
Sure.
They want to respond smart. So that's why all these things are beginning to finally take hold. But it's stuff we've been pushing for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, give these guys a KOA-style parking lot where they can dump their trash, dump their human waste, have access to clean water, and more importantly, access to services. So if you have drug addiction services or mental health services or just trying to get up off your feet and find a job, it's all centralized. It saves the city a tremendous amount of money by having one central area. And that also reduces the burden on SDOT, who had to clean up 1.9 million pounds of trash last year.
That's Magnolia resident Harley Lever. He created the community group Safe Seattle to demand solutions to the RV problem. And Bill Curlin Hackett, director of the Interfaith Task Force on Homelessness. Again, sources at Seattle City Hall tell KUOW the mayor is expected to make an announcement today about opening two new designated parking areas for RVs in Seattle. This is KUOW's The Record. Elsewhere in the news today, in Washington State, how did our state mistakenly release thousands of prisoners for more than a decade? In Olympia, they're trying to figure out how it happened. The governor has launched an independent investigation, but Republican state lawmakers say that's not enough. They want subpoena power. KUOW's Austin Jenkins covers the state capitol. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Bill.
Briefly remind us what the state is investigating here.
Well, it's basically the early or premature release of more than 3,000 inmates going back to 2002, so spanning 13 years, and the fact that the problem was discovered in 2012 because a victim's family flagged the problem. They thought their offender was getting out too early, and the Department of Corrections failed to fix the problem. Apparently, there were 16 opportunities to do so, and each time it didn't happen. So really, it's a twofold issue that's being investigated.
And Governor Inslee has said what so far?
Well, the governor has said that he's outraged, that this is unacceptable, that it's a failure, and that he intends to get to the bottom of it. He said that he will fix it and fix it right. And one of the things he was going to do to get to the bottom of this is to hire a couple of former federal prosecutors to conduct an outside or independent investigation into how this could have happened and why it wasn't fixed. And the governor says that individuals should be held to account. And he said he's eager to take that action, but he thinks that it would be premature to do so before the results of this investigation are in and there's been some conclusion about what actually happened and who knew what when.
So why do Senate Republicans want something more? They want their own investigation.
They do indeed. They are saying two things. One is that they feel they are under some obligation to conduct their own investigation. And they're also raising questions about whether the governor's investigation can be trusted because it is being operated out of the executive office, the governor's office, and obviously the Department of Corrections is an executive agency. So they are intending, they being Senate Republicans, are intending to pursue their own investigation using a very rarely used legislative subpoena power.
So are the Republicans accusing the Inslee administration of a cover-up?
I wouldn't say that they're accusing the Inslee administration of a cover-up at this point. More what they're saying is that they don't necessarily trust the independence of this investigation. They're also saying they don't absolutely trust that they're getting all the information out of the executive branch, and they want to use this subpoena power to sort of compel that. But, you know, just by using subpoena power, they've also amped this up. I mean, they've certainly they've raised the stakes, and they're using this rarely used tool. It's getting some attention and some headlines. So it has created an atmosphere where the legislative branch, and specifically Senate Republicans, are very much front and center as this scandal, frankly, plays out here in Olympia.
And how much does all of this have to do with the fact that the governor's running for re-election this fall.
Clearly, there are political considerations and implications here. I mean, this is an election year. This is being viewed as a scandal in the executive branch. Of course, it dates back before the governor, before Inslee was governor. But clearly, there is a political overlay to this early release situation. It would be naive to say or to think otherwise.
Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins will stay on the story for you. Austin, thank you.
You're welcome.